Got you out of fellowship. Now you can rebound. I give you something to rebound before class. We're here dealing with this incident that is unfolding at the base of the Mount of Transfiguration, where the disciples have, Jesus and the three, have come upon a rather tense, I presume, sort of tense environment, argumentative environment, where the scribes are obviously one of the things they're doing is using this failure of the apostles, no doubt, to not only attack them, but to attack Jesus. But it appears one of the things that we will see as we watch this unfold, while the scribes are mentioned here initially, they fade from the scene very quickly. They aren't really mentioned again. It's almost like they kind of disappear. So I don't know if they hung around and observed any further, or if when Jesus showed up, they said, uh-oh, the jig's up, and ran. Who knows? It's hard to tell what they would have done. But they sort of fade into the scene. In fact, so the crowd and, it's mentioned here, but the crowd is only mentioned again one more time, and the scribes aren't mentioned at all. So we had gotten down to point 18 that Mark uses this relatively rare verb, ekthambeo, to describe the crowd's initial response, but we're not told what their immediate motivation was. We will find out that they're excited about this idea of a deliverance. Well, 19, the sense of being amazed, as the New American Standard translation has it, does not seem to fit the context, since Jesus has done nothing at that point that would call for that type of response. Again, I think close to our term sight would be more close to what the idea of it is here. They're excited about it. I mean, it's kind of a stimulating deal. They've heard about Jesus, no doubt, and certainly this incident that has unfolded apparently just previously that morning, as one would assume, has really got them jazzed up, that there's been a showdown, a demonic showdown, that the apostles lost. So that would in itself be somewhat of a weird deal to watch that people would be excited by. Well, 20, some have suggested that the excitement of the crowd was due to the fact that they believed that Jesus was going to resolve the dispute between the scribes and the disciples. However, they are more likely exhibiting the emotional excitement that one would expect of a group that thought Jesus could do what his disciples had been unable to do. I'm presuming their excitement stemmed from the sense that, okay, now we'll see where the real power lies. And so there had been no indication, by the way, at any time up until this point, that Jesus himself personally had ever been anything less than 100% successful with healings, miracles, multiplying food, casting out demons. And so no doubt they thought, oh good, okay, now we'll get to see a show, in a sense. Well, 21, as the crowd moves towards Jesus, they exhibit that they are glad to see him, greeting him and welcoming him to their area. And 22, at this point, Jesus asks a question, which was likely directed toward the nine apostles that had remained behind. It is clear that the grammar is somewhat ambiguous here, since the term crowd is the nearest antecedent. And that is, they were greeting him is the verb. They were running up to him and were greeting him. And so they're the nearest antecedent verbally. And he asked them. So, if one takes the near antecedent, it would be the crowd. I don't think that's what's in view here, though. I think he's quizzing the nine, more likely. Well, 23, however, there is no evidence that the crowd had been involved in the dispute. Nevertheless, they were certainly interested spectators. I don't think there's much doubt about that. 24, it makes more sense that Jesus would address this question to his disciples rather than the scribes. As such, the question likely had a mild element of rebuke, since Jesus had previously told the apostles to leave the scribes and Pharisees alone, Matthew 15:14, and that was in the context, of course, when the disciples illustrate how maladjusted they are as they chide Jesus for not being nice enough to the Pharisees. And that's in verse 12, when the disciples came and said to him, "Do you know that the Pharisees were offended when they heard this statement?" And in verse 14, he gives his official view on this and tells them, "Let them alone. Separate from them. Leave them alone." Just leave them alone. Anybody, and essentially, basically for a local church, it becomes relatively easy, and to my estimation, as we consider what the Scripture says. And typically, those on the outside, just leave them alone. Let them do what they're going to do. A good, bad, or otherwise, they're going to answer to God for it, not you, not me. So in one sense, the disciples had sort of the same, I think, somewhat easy deal in that all they had to do is leave people outside of the group alone. And as we find out later on, when John, you know, kind of brags to Jesus, hey, we stopped him because he wasn't following us. He gets rebuked for that. He says, you know, no, leave him alone. And so in a sense, for us, it becomes pretty simple. It's not that I'm never aware of what goes on out there. I mean, I'm pretty aware of what's happening theologically and what people are doing. But in large measure, I just don't have to deal with it. Anything really outside of my basic niche of pastoring and teaching, to a large measure, I don't really care about either. I mean, I'm in mourning, you know, but today, mostly I don't care about it. But, you know, the Sooners have killed me again. Well, bad coaching will do you in sometimes. And calling timeouts when the other team has the ball, that's smart. Not smart. All right, well, there's your football lesson today. So had to share my intense heart attack pain. So basically, though, those on the outside, again, it's pretty simple. Leave them alone. Just let them do what they're going to do. You don't have to have any animosity towards them. You don't have to hate them. You don't have to even concern yourself with them. And Paul will articulate this very much to the Corinthians. What have I to do with outsiders? Basically, my concern is the local church. That is my milieu, and that is where I am going to operate. So he had already told them to leave him alone. Now, in this case, I don't think that the apostles probably initiated the argument. I think they probably fell into it. I would presume that the scribes saw this failure as, aha, let's pounce now because clearly they have failed and we've got something we can latch on to here. And plus, everybody has seen it. How many ever people were in that crowd? They'd seen that failure. Well, 25, the presence of the scribes suggests that they had been privy to the attempted exorcism and may have attacked the disciples about their authority for doing such things. That's one thing. By whose authority are you acting? That could be one approach to them, certainly. And we know that ultimately this became an issue in many cases in the ministry of Jesus. As they would say, by what authority are you doing these things? And he said, well, let me ask you a question. By what authority do you do things? So he turns around on them with that question about John the Baptist. Was his a baptism from heaven or from men? Oh, well, don't want to answer. Okay, well, I'm not telling you why I do it either. Or where my authority comes from. Well, his authority comes from God. I know where it comes from. Well, 26, this seems to have been an isolated incident, which will be confirmed by the testimony of the man in the crowd that was about to answer Jesus. The apostles did not begin any sort of healing or deliverance ministry in Jesus' absence. Some interpreters have suggested that. I reject that offhand pretty much. I don't see them at the base of the mountain saying, okay, let's get a ministry cranked up here. I mean, no doubt, my perception would be that Jesus said, I'm taking Peter, James, and John. The rest of you stay here. We'll be back. Now, did he tell them, we'll be back in the morning? Did Jesus know he was going to spend the night on the mountain? I presume he did. But how much his humanity knows sometimes is difficult to say because his humanity just has to live every second like you and I live. And that is either we walk in conscious dependence and fellowship with God or we don't. And he just did it perfectly. He never got out of fellowship, never got angry. Of course, no mental attitude sins, no verbal sins, certainly no overt sins. I mean, so to the point where he could literally challenge them at the end of his ministry. Which one of you can convict me of sin? The answer was none of them. Show me where I've sinned. He would challenge them. Boy, that'd be nice, I think. But unfortunately, I don't get to do it. Oh, I don't have to ask you to show me where I've sinned. Some of you would probably be all too happy. But I already know. So you're not obviously going to issue that kind of challenge. Jesus could, because he was perfect. So again, to suggest that they decide, oh, we're going to crank something up here, I don't think that happened at all. I think the man came to them. They had been successful in the past, and they were probably a little filled up with themselves. We know they were. And so they didn't think anything about it. They just thought this was going to go just the same way it's always gone. We've done this before. This is easy. You don't need Jesus. We're here. And we're going to find out that didn't work for him. Well, 27, it seems evident that the man had brought his son to Jesus, who had been absent from the other nine apostles for a period of about 15 to 18 hours. This presumes that he ascended the mountain the previous evening around dusk, say maybe 5 or 6, and arrived back by about 10 the next morning. I mean, I don't know exactly what the time was, but I mean, just to give you, if they went, and I don't, again, think they had to go to the top of Mount Hermon. They could have gone on a 10,000, 9,000 foot mountain. You don't have to go to the top to get away from people. You're not to the very top. I mean, he could have gone up the mountain several thousand feet and been away from everybody. So again, presuming these figures, and these are only just estimates. I would like to make it plain when I, have documentation this is just my best guess here. Had they left that afternoon and didn't get back till the next afternoon, it would have been 24 hours. So, but it was no more to my thinking than, half or three quarters of a day. Well, 28, when Jesus was not available, he likely sought the aid of the apostles. There was no reason for them to refuse since they had engaged in successful exorcisms in the past. We saw that in 6:13 that they had been sent out and they had been successful. And again, while I wouldn't attribute unqualified success to their deeds, the implication I get is that they were largely successful. To the point where they expected success. That becomes a problem now, doesn't it? When you begin to presume, well, this has been done this way in the past, so therefore it'll always work. Oh, wait a second. That's not true. Some things that people do in the past don't work the second time. And you better figure what they are. Well, 29, given what we know of the aggressive nature of the apostles, it would not be surprising if they took the initiative and began to deal with the boy on their own, confidently presuming that this would be another simple victory for them. And 30, when they proved to be unable to handle the situation, the scribes would likely have taken that opportunity to attack them, ridicule their failure, and malign their master. And that, to me, makes perfect sense. That's kind of their mode. They're in the attack mode most of the time with Jesus anyway, if not all the time by now. And so the idea that they would have done this, to me, doesn't seem unusual. In fact, I would have expected it of them. And 31, one would not expect that the apostles told the man that they had, or one would expect, rather, that the apostles told the man that they had experience in this area and that Jesus' presence was not required. And they had. They had experience in this area, and they'd done it outside of Jesus' presence before. What was different here? That becomes a real big question that we'll have to address and we will have to answer. What is different here in this situation that they confronted that they hadn't confronted before? And as we're going to find out, we don't really find out from Mark. One might say, well, it was because they didn't pray about it. That's true at some level. Because Mark just says, Jesus told him this kind, in verse 29, cannot come out by anything other than fasting or by prayer. Some texts even add fasting here, fasting and prayer. Although the better texts don't have it. The New American Standard has got it right here as far as I understand it from the criticism aspect, the textual criticism aspect. The New American Standard is right here. He didn't say fasting and prayer. He said prayer. But what is it, had they not prayed about it? What was the deal? And we find out in the other synoptic parallel, I believe it's Matthew, and he said the real problem is your lack of faith, that they had not exercised faith in this matter. And that is manifested by their lack of prayer. So we'll get to that as we go too. So 32, as the incident unfolds, they will find out they were completely wrong about how this was going to go. Their failure gave the scribes reason to attack and expose the apostles as spiritual frauds. And I don't think that there's any doubt that's what they did. Look, these men aren't what they said they are. They can't do what they said they could do. This is bogus, and we're here to point it out. And, of course, they would have loved that. That would have been, to them, a great day. Wow, this is just what we were hoping for. Well, 33, at this point, the nine apostles had to be pretty upset. I don't think they're in a real, fun frame of mind by this time. First, they failed, and they failed publicly. How do you feel when that happens? Do you like going out and making a fool out of yourself in front of people? I don't think most people like that. The idea, we just covered the doctrine of shame, embarrassment and shame, it's not so cool necessarily. I mean, we've all done it, but it's not fun, is it? You don't really, like that. So they had been bested in a contest of power by a demon. They had been embarrassed by their failure in the front of the crowd that had assembled, and they had to endure the public criticism of their opponents, which in this case would be justified. It's not just that they were attacking them, it's that they were right when they were attacking them. You guys don't have what you thought you had. You're not who you think you are. And thank God we're here to see this. Well, 34, add to this fact that Jesus now reappears. Add to this the fact that Jesus now reappears. And ask for an immediate explanation about what had been transpired. Now, how do you feel when your boss walks up and you've got egg all over your face? And you know, Jesus looks at him and they've got if you could see it, they would have egg all over their face and they stand there, humiliated, no doubt, upset. And Jesus doesn't say, well, I'm sorry you guys are upset. I mean, he goes right for the juggler here. What's going on? So he asked for an immediate explanation, and they now have to relate their failure to Jesus before the assembled group. You've not only failed, now you're going to have to rehearse it for them in front of your enemies here and these people. And now explain to me what's going on. And I think that's exactly why I take his question to be directed to the apostles, because he wants an explanation from them. And 35, neither the scribes or the apostles play any further role in this incident. And the reaction of the crowd is the only further thing mentioned to them. They're mentioned once again in verse 25, and the fact that it was growing, the crowd was growing at this. And you get this kind of, you know, loud turmoil and clamor. And to what extent that the people around this region, assuming we're still in Caesarea Philippi, to what extent that they knew about the hostility and the conflict that existed between Jesus and the scribes, it's hard to say. But I'm presuming that this incident just got louder, more people were gathering, and that's what normally happens when these kinds of things erupt. People got to stop and find out what's going on. You know? And so they do. So the crowd grows. When Jesus saw that a crowd was rapidly gathering, he rebuked the unclean spirit. And that's the last mention of the crowd, sort of. Then they just sort of fade into the deal, too. But then Jesus immediately departs, so that would probably disperse the crowd to my thinking that when he goes into the house and gets away from them wherever he goes, then therefore they've got no reason to hang around. This is all over and, you know, nothing to see here kind of deal. Well, 36, many have noticed that the scribes do not apparently respond to all this. But there is no reason for them to do so. They have had their moment of victory over the apostles, but they did not appear to be willing to confront Jesus. Wise move. That would have been very dumb of them. And so, you know, and maybe they figured that out too. Okay, hey, we've had our day. Okay, we win this one. Bye. And I mean, I won't have any problem believing that's the way they thought about it. Well, now verse 17. So before the apostles can answer, this guy answers Jesus' question. One of the crowd answered him, "Teacher, I brought you my son possessed with a spirit which makes him mute. And is Kai," they've actually translated it this time, "he answered or responded as apokrinomai," and this gets into the mental response that one composes, apokrinomai, oops. This comes from the root word to judge, from, and it means to make distinctions or decisions within your mind, and the idea is that typically before you speak out loud, you're supposed to think. And, you know, consider what you're saying before you say it. That's the idea of the verb. So he responded to him. Him is Jesus in this context, autos, the dative. Numeral heis here, from the crowd, preposition ek, plus the word aklos again, out from the crowd. Teacher, didaskalos here. This isn't too instructive because, as we're going to see, both Jesus' friends and enemies referred to him as teacher. So this doesn't tell us anything about the guy. Is he a believer? Is he not a believer? This was just a comment. And this very much, by the way, reflects the Aramaic rabbi. These are in large measure at this time in history synonyms. My great one, and the idea is a teacher who instructs disciples or learners. And who follow, and they follow him. Essentially, if you attach yourself to this teacher, well, obviously, this just becomes a term by which And this wasn't unusual in that there were many traveling teachers at that point in Jewish history. Jesus was not the only one. So, teacher, I brought is Pharaoh to bear or carry. This word is used. Normally it means to pick something up, to bear or to carry it along. But I've noticed in Mark, the longer I studied Mark, that really Mark's nuance of it is not physically carrying as much as it is bringing somebody. And so they've reflected this in the New American Standard. I brought you my son. How he got him there, I mean, I assume he walked him there. Presuming, you know. The son of me, my son, ho huios, the word for son, and then ego, my, pronoun ego. To you, preposition pros. Now here the man makes it very plain with the accusative of Sue. I brought him to you. I was looking for you. I didn't come here looking for these men. I came looking for you. That's why I'm here. To you, having, or because he has, here you have a participle, because he has, a present active participle of echo, the verb, to have, because he has a spirit, a mute. And you got the word for spirit, which of course refers in this context to a fallen angel, a demon, and then a mute, one might say alelos, A-L-A-L-O-S, alelos. Three times this word means mute, unable to speak. And so one might say, well, it's a mute spirit. That means the spirit can't speak. No, he's talking about the effect that the demon has on the boy. It's not that the demon himself is mute or deaf. If you got a deaf demon, you really got a problem. How are you going to command him to do anything? He's deaf. Well, you don't have deaf demons. Demons can hear. What he's talking about here, it's my metonymy, the cause for the effect. And that's not an unusual grammatical function. And whenever it seizes him, it throws him down and he foams at the mouth and grinds his teeth and stiffens out. I told your disciples to cast it out and they could not do it. And is Kai here, when or whenever, and what you have here is hapu, which is an adverb of place. Or pardon me, hapu is an adverb of, well, it can be used of both place and time, actually. Where or when, but it's followed by this particle of contingency, ian. And so very often when you have these conditional clauses, and then you have either a definitive subject mentioned, like the relative pronoun hosts, or you have a specific place or time mentioned, where or when, then that becomes indefinite itself because of the nature of the construction. So whenever is the idea here, when, if it might seize him. And the idea of all that is whenever it does seize him. If is the conjunction ian here. Him, you got the accusative of autos, which is the pronoun. But in this context, autos refers to the boy. And then seizes is katalambano. K-A-T-A-L-A-M-B-A-N-O. Lambano means to take or receive. Kata has the idea of down. The verb's used 15 times. It means to make something one's own. To win something. To attain to something. To take control of someone by some means, whether physically or in this case spiritually. So note here that the demon is the subject, the unclean spirit. Although that term is actually neuter, and that's another thing you have to, when you deal with the text, I like it to watch first and second and third year Greek students who think they know a little Greek. All it does is make them dangerous. They're like a first year med student. Don't put a scalpel in their hand, for God's sake. You know, first year Greek students shouldn't be allowed to touch the Bible. They shouldn't be allowed to even look at it. Because they know just enough to where they think they've got it. And the arrogance of a first or second year Greek student, well, if Pete taught Greek, you can ask him on the side if you want to know. He will attest to the arrogance he has seen in people. Not me, of course, but other people. Yeah, I was an arrogant Greek student too once. But that's until you start studying it. And then sometimes, you know, God will kick all that out of you because you realize how little you do know. So an idea that somebody can pick up a little Greek a year or two and teach, oh my God, that is the worst possible thing that could happen. They can't. And what you have here, and the reason I'm saying all this is to point out to you that the verb here is an aorist active subjunctive, third person singular, and the idea here is that the term pneuma is neuter. And so sometimes spirits will be referred to as neuter or masculine. Now, why? Well, neuter is the grammatical sense of the term. But that's not sexual gender. And that's another thing that most first-year Greek students, some Greek students never pick it up, that grammatical gender is not sexual gender. That shouldn't be hard to understand, but some still don't grasp it, trust me. And so they want to make a big deal out of this. Well, sometimes the demon is spoken of by grammatical gender, and other times he's spoken of by logical gender. All demons are male. And the Holy Spirit, same thing is true of him. The word spirit, again, is pneuma, neuter. And sometimes he's spoken of as grammatical gender, a spirit. Other times he's spoken of as a masculine. Why? Because all members of the Godhead are only referred to with masculine pronouns. Not neuter or feminine. Never a feminine, in fact. And only the Holy Spirit's ever referred to as a neuter pronoun. Jesus never is. So they see this first year, second year Greek students, they see this, the Holy Spirit's not masculine. He's a neuter. It's a spirit. It's not masculine or feminine. No. He's referred to as male on certain occasions. So this is where you have to know these kinds of things, and a little Greek just is dangerous in the hands of a novice sometimes. And you have to recognize that too. So again, here, the demon is the subject. He takes hold of him, seizes him there, and throws him down. Present active indicative, third person singular of regnumi. H-R-E-G-N-U-M-I. Regnumi, seven times, literally to break apart or tear into pieces. It's used of breaking like a vase, or shattering it. Well, clearly, the Spirit doesn't rip him to shreds. That would be reading too much into this word in this context. But it has the idea of distorting his body. It has the idea, as we're going to see, if you've ever seen a person have a seizure, you understand the distortions that occur within the physical body as the electrical impulses from the brain, for whatever reason, get disrupted, and boom, then you've got this physical expression of electrical energy in the brain gone bad. And that's kind of what you're going to see here. Most interpreters here acknowledge that this very much sounds like epilepsy. But, and some of them, so much so that they say, see, the kid really wasn't demon-possessed. You know, it was a physical malady that Jesus healed. But by the time you get down to the end of this, Jesus said, you deaf and mute spirit, verse 25, I command you to come out of him. Jesus never talks as though it's physical illness. He always speaks of it as though it's demonic. The Father waffles back and forth. He mentions in Mark that it's demonic, and in Matthew he says he's sick. Well, which is it? Well, the fact is, as we know, demonic possession can mimic certain physical symptoms of illness, like deafness. But is all deafness demonic? No. Can a demon cause seizures? Yes. Are all seizures ipso facto proof of demon possession? No. Same thing with blindness. There were demons that could cause blindness, apparently. So when you think about it, one of the things as a believer you should walk around with a conscious awareness of, and that is how much God must protect us. Because the idea that, well, you have to be demon-possessed for this to happen, I don't know, because first, the word is demonized in the Greek. There is no term for strict demon possession in the Greek language at all, or at least not used in the New Testament. But so it means to have a demon, and we know that demons can impact believers. I mean, we learn that in 1 Timothy. It's evident that they can. They can get their doctrines in. So God obviously protects us to a very great level. That these malignant spirits aren't able to do this to believers in large measure. That's a part of God's sovereign protection over believers, which is good. Well, it literally tears him apart is kind of, you know, it would be our vernacular. It tears him apart when this happens. Not that he's physically torn to shreds. That would make recovery hard. And then him as Altos, the accused, the boy. It throws him down. It distorts him, we might say. And Kai, he foams at the mouth, is aphrizo. Aphrizo. Only used two times, to foam at the mouth, to slobber uncontrollably. And Kai, then the next verb, present active indicative of trizo. These are somewhat unique terms. This one's only used here. To make a shrill cry. It's used of any sharp or unpleasant sound. When used of the teeth, it means to grind or gnash them. If you ever hear a person grinding their teeth, it's not a pleasant sound. You don't say, oh, whoopee, I'm going to put that on my falling asleep thing. You know, you don't do that. So, and then you have here, and context tells you this word's used of a number of different unpleasant sounds, but here you got odous, with the definite article, O-D-O-U-S, which means a tooth. And actually, it's accusative masculine plural, teeth. And he stiffens out. Actually, the verb you've got here, a present passive indicative of zeraino, X-E-R-A-I-N-O. Zeraino, and this word means literally to stop the flow of fluid. It literally means to dry up. But when it talks and it's used of bodies, it apparently means to become stiff or rigid. And I presume that the drying up would kind of refer to the drying up of movement, we might say. His movements become stiff and rigid to the point where finally he doesn't move. I told your disciples to cast it out. I asked or told is ipon. Again, the verb means to tell or to say. It's the aorist indicative of lego. But in context, it's probably a request or even possibly a command. You know, please cast, more likely a request, please cast this demon out of my son. And your apostles, or your disciples, is mathetes again, of you, genitive of su, that or in order that, here again in terms of a request or even a command sometimes, you'll find hina, because it expresses both the content of the command or the request and the fact of the purpose of it is included in it. And I asked them, and I told your disciples to cast it out, and they could not. In order that it, again here you've got the demon. Now this autos is neuter, so clearly it goes back to the demon in context. To cast it out is ekbalo, to throw or cast out from, as it were, and they did not have the power. This is the only place I would make it here a change. You got the negative ooh. If he wanted to say they were not able, he would have used dunamai. And that verb means exactly that, to have power or to be able to do something. And in fact, that's what's used in Matthew. They were not able to do it. But here, iskuo gets into I-S-C-H-U-O, this verb, means to have power or might, to be strong or competent. And the idea is, in a showdown with a demon, it becomes a matter of who's more powerful, you or the demon. And he points out here, and I doubt that the demon, the apostles liked hearing this either, your apostles lack power. How's that? Now what are you going to do? Well, the apostles probably didn't care to hear that, but that was the truth. They lacked power at this point. Why did they lack power? They'd had power before. Well, exposition of 17 and 18 here. One, the three synoptic accounts of this incident vary dramatically from one another, as they each present this event unfolding in a different way. Two, Mark has the crowd seeing Jesus and rushing to him, with Jesus taking time to question the nine apostles about what had been going on. He is then answered by a man from the crowd. Well, that all sounds pretty straightforward, till you start comparing the other accounts. And that's probably, you know, pretty much a synopsis of what happened. Well, three, Matthew's account mentions nothing of the conflict between the scribes and the apostles. But again, part of Mark's purpose is to show us the apostles in all their unmitigated glory. I mean, you know, stupidity, i.e. And their failures, and the reality of what they were. Not as they're known by the time Mark writes this, in the 50s or even early 60s A.D., the apostles were great fixtures of the church. Well, part of Mark's deal is to let people know, you know, these men struggle just like you do. They fail just like you do. And they face these same types of tests. Well, so he mentions nothing of it, but records the fact that a man comes forward from the crowd and falls on his knees in front of Jesus. Matthew 17:14. And we're going to be paging back between Matthew, Mark, and Luke, so you may just want to put a little marker in there and won't have to look up the deal every time. And when they came to the crowd, a man came up to Jesus falling on his knees before him. Well, that doesn't militate against the crowd coming, the whole crowd coming. It doesn't say they didn't. So that doesn't make Mark correct or incorrect. It's just the way they choose to record this. Well, four, Luke's account has the crowd coming toward Jesus and one man from the crowd shouting out to him. Again, no mention of the conflict with the scribes. That's in Luke 9:38. And a man from the crowd shouted, saying, "Teacher, I beg you to look at my son, for he is my only boy." That's another incident, a little detail, that only Luke mentions, and that is that this guy is his only child. Again, which is designed, I think, to add pathos to the situation. So five, all three accounts agree on the fact that the disciples had attempted to deal with this situation and were not able to perform the exorcism successfully. Matthew 17:16, "I brought him to your disciples, and they could not cure him." And I'll just double check, but I'm almost certain that it's, they were not able. He uses dunamai, and with a complementary infinitive. They were not able to heal or cure him. And that's another thing we get from Matthew's account. There's more emphasis on the sickness or the disease aspect of it. Whereas in Mark's account, the only emphasis is on the demon. And I'll explain to you why that is. Mark 9:18, that's our verse. And then Luke 9:40. "I begged your disciples to cast it out. And they could not." And in Luke there, let me just double check it, 9:40. And they were not able. He uses dunamai as well. He doesn't use the complementary infinitive. He just says they were not able, that they didn't have the ability. So six, putting this all together, it would seem the event unfolded as follows. A man brings his demonized son to Jesus, wanting him to exorcise the demon that possessed his boy. It turns out that this was his only son, adding to the pathos of the situation. That's the emotional aspect to it, of course, as people are, would be much more reticent. You wouldn't want it to happen to any child. I mean, it's not like, if a parent had four kids, they'd say, okay, it doesn't matter. The other three are fine. No parent would do that. No good parent. But since it is his only son, it kind of is like the deal with Jairus' daughter. It appears it was his only daughter, and that just adds to it all. Well, B, since Jesus was not present, the man asked the apostles to intervene on his son's behalf and cast out the demon. All of the accounts agree that he says, he doesn't say he said, "I brought him to your disciples," in Matthew, "and they could not cure him." He doesn't say he asked them. But the implication is, of course, and the other ones do say, that he did ask. But again, I believe you have to factor in the mindset of the apostles, and they're all too willing to step forward and say, "Yeah, we can do it, no problem. We've done it before." And on our verse, and then 9:40, "I begged your disciples to cast it out, and they could not." And in Luke 9:40, it's deo, or deomai. So it does mean to make a request or a petition. So according to the man, he did ask. See, the apostles were not spiritually strong enough to handle this particular demon, who may have been the most powerful demon they had confronted to that point. We certainly know that in the demonic realm there is a hierarchy. We understand that there are demons that are more powerful, there are demons that are in charge of nations, then there are demons in charge of major cities, then demons in charge of lesser cities, probably demons in charge of counties, various cities, and on down, who knows, depending upon how many demons there are. And we really don't know how many demons there are. We don't have a fixed number for the angels. We know that the number of angels is finite. But we also know that the unfallen angels outnumber the fallen angels 2-1. But in terms of relative numbers, the angels are very often likened to the stars of the heavens. Well, how many stars are up there from your perspective? And I'm not talking about in a technical sense of what's a galaxy, what's a star, what's a planet. When you look up, you don't think galaxies, nebulae, or anything else. You think stars. You know. So how many stars are there from the human perspective? Well, there's a lot of them. I mean, you can go out and you got to get away from the city, but you go out somewhere where it's really dark some night and look at the heavens and you'll think, wow, there's more than I can count. So again, we don't know how broken down the hierarchy is. We just know that there are demons that are more powerful than other demons. When they later privately asked Jesus about the reason for their lack of success, he indicated that their basic problem was their lack of faith, which was manifested by a lack of reliance on God in prayer. Now, Matthew 17:20, he said to them, they asked him in verse 19, why could we not drive it out? And he said, because of the littleness of your faith. And so Jesus then here in Matthew uses a term or a teaching that we have seen in other contexts. And he will do, this is one of the things about the teaching of Jesus. He would very often teach the same principles in a variety of contexts to bring out nuances to that context. I say to you, because of the littleness of your faith. For truly I say to you, if you have faith the size of a mustard seed, and we know that from a study of Mark 4, the mustard seed is the smallest of all the garden herbs that one can typically grow, of all the herbs, and it becomes the largest of all the plants. But in another context, that has to do with the transcendent glory of the kingdom as seen from its humble beginnings. Well, that's not what's in view here. This is a completely different context. Same teaching. If you have faith the size of a mustard seed, you will say to this mountain, move from here to there, and it will move, and nothing will be impossible for you. See, what he doesn't say here that you have to figure out from doctrine and understanding is that, yeah, you have to also be doing this in the will of God. You can't just arbitrarily walk around, start moving mountains. Hey, I'm show you I'm a great, my faith is, what's this? Oh, well, you can imagine that. I'd move the Rockies here. So I could ski. I'd change the climate, too. Well, if I'm going to do it, change the climate so we get snow, have the trout streams, you know, everything, not just the mountain. I want the whole deal. Well, you've got to, also, you've got to be in God's will. You can't just arbitrarily do this. But, and that's what happens sometimes, you know, people will read this and they say, well, it's just a blank check. I can do whatever I want. Well, yes, with other considerations, sure. And we've seen it in, well, we will see it. We're not there yet, but Mark 9:29. In our passage, he said, this kind cannot come out by anything but prayer. So the equivalency here is that the problem was their lack of faith as expressed by their lack of prayer. They just dove into it on their own strength. They didn't call on God or try to get any insight or into this. They just said, we got it. Well, Jesus Christ and the three apostles are descending from the mountain and become aware of a loud disturbance in the midst of a crowd that had assembled. If the crowd sees Jesus and rushes towards him, forgetting for a moment the arguing scribes and apostles. The apostles join the crowd and move toward Jesus, as he certainly continues to approach them. When he is close enough to the apostles, he asks them what had been happening. And as Jesus and the crowd approach each other, the people are likely talking excitedly, and one man comes forward about the time Jesus questions his disciples. And I think this all has to happen, you know, fairly bam, 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 pretty quickly. It doesn't take forever for this to unfold. And then he likely begins his loud request from within the crowd, but then comes forward and falls on his knees in front of Jesus. It is at this time he answers Jesus' question and asks him to address the situation. So 7, therefore, before the apostles could respond to Jesus' question, the boy of the father explained to him what had been happening. And 8, like the previous incident near Tyre, there is no indication as to what caused the child to become possessed in the first place. Therefore, speculation about the cause of possession does not serve the interpreter. I've seen people say, well, his father was involved in the occult. Based on what? I know you've got a lot of documentation for this view. Now, where is it? You don't have any? Well, then don't say it. You know, you don't know. I don't know what the situation was. But one thing we can say for certain is that demons are no respecters of persons. Age does not matter to them. Now, if the boy is young, let's say he's 7 or 8. Well, how involved in the occult could he be? I mean, he doesn't have a Ouija board yet. You know, he's not reading it. What's he reading, his horoscope, and that's it? The demon possesses him because of that? Well, good Lord, then practically most people in America are demon possessed then. But, you know, we don't know why he was demon possessed. We're not told. And it just stuns me that interpreters will look at this stuff and say, well, here's the reason. Well, good grief. Based on what? I mean, please show me something. No, they can't. So I really, one of the things you learn, of course, is not to make these dogmatic pontifications that you can't even document. Ah, it's all demon possession because it's all occult. They were involved in the occult. Well, you don't. Maybe they were, maybe they weren't. Well, 9, the man approaches Jesus, addressing him with a respectful title, makes his very emotional appeal, and explains the reason for the conflict between the apostles and the scribes. And 10, the use of the term didaskalos, teacher, was a title that was used of Jesus both by his disciples and by those that were outside the body of disciples. So in that regard, the term is not unusual. In fact, it is, in a sense, the term that would be applied towards any teacher of that time. Again, roughly equivalent to the Aramaic rabbi. Mark 5:35, and while he was still speaking, they came from the house of the synagogue official saying, your daughter has died. Why trouble the teacher anymore? 10:17 also. And as he was setting out on a journey, a man ran up to him and knelt before him and asked him, good teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life? And you think, oh, well, a teacher be proud for some society. And Jesus said, why are you calling me good? Nobody's good but God alone. So do you think I'm God? That was the essence of that question. Do you think I'm God? And the answer was, if they were smart, yes. But nobody answered that way. Nobody thought he was God. Well, 13 and 14. And they sent some of the Pharisees and the Herodians in order to trap him in a statement. Oh, these guys are good. They came and said to him, teacher, we know that you are truthful. And defer to no, oh boy. Watch it when they start to flatter you. Well, I know you're a really great teacher. Oh boy, pick it up your feet. Here it comes. For you are truthful and defer to no one, for you are not partial to any, but teach the way of God in truth. Really? Is that what you believe? They don't believe that for a second. Is it lawful to pay a poll tax to Caesar or not? No, it's about money. That's really what you're interested in. Well, 11, the fact that his disciples used the term should not be considered unusual. However, the fact that the Gentiles and his enemies used it would tend to indicate that this had become the general title by which Jesus had become known. But again, because of the nature of traveling teachers and rabbis at that time, this would not have at all been unusual. So this would have just been a normal term, and it doesn't mean they embrace Jesus or they think his teaching is correct or anything else. It's just a way to address him, really. It's probably no more equivalent than, again, to our sir, as they would use kurios in the same way, Lord or Master. It would be equivalent to our sir. This is just a nice way of addressing Jesus, you know, a non-offensive way that would be acceptable to everybody. Well, 12, Mark's is the only account that makes it explicit that Jesus had been the object of his search. The man did not seek the apostles initially, but settled for the second string. Who likely assured him that there would be no problem. I can run it, coach. Put me in. We'll see. You watch it every year as these kids come out of college, sometimes before they really should, and go into the pros, and they think, oh, I'm going to make it. And, you know, they, and particularly if they're quarterbacks, they get put in there and they're just thrown to the dogs. And, I mean, they just mangle them. And, no, you can't handle. And here the second string couldn't handle this one, as we're going to see. Well, 13, throughout this account, the man consistently refers to his son's problem in terms of demon possession rather than in medical terms. And 14, it is clear that his symptoms correspond in many ways to the symptoms of an epileptic seizure, which causes many interpreters to teach that this was really a medical issue. And to that, only thing I have to say is, what do you do with Mark 9:25 when Jesus rebuked the unclean spirit and it came out of him? You got to throw this verse out if you want to make this strictly just medical. And so you can't, as we're going to see. Well, 15, nevertheless, all... And why interpreters go... I don't understand. It's not that hard to limit yourself to what the text says. You've got to be kind of arrogant to really go beyond that. You've got to limit yourself. That's what exegesis is, limiting yourself to what the text says. So nevertheless, all three synoptic accounts relate the incident as an exorcism. While Matthew uses the term selenizomai, which literally means to be moonstruck or to be a lunatic, Luke, who is a physician, he's a doctor, only relates the story in terms of possession. So Matthew's account, as we will see, the father does talk in medical terms at that time. Now, did he believe it was medical or, you know, and does Jesus just cater in some level? What's the point of arguing? Now, this isn't medical, sir. This is a demon. Other accounts have him saying it's demonic. Matthew's doesn't. But the reality is he does talk in very much in medical terms in Matthew, which is that again, troubles some interpreters because he talks about in verse 16, they could not cure him. They didn't say cast out the demon. They say cure or heal. And I believe it's therapeuo. There. And Jesus, and in verse 15, he says, Lord, have mercy on my son, for he is a lunatic. Now, that doesn't mean, you know, what we typically tend to think of lunatic as. It comes from the Greek, from the root lunar, our word for moon. And selene, the root of that verb I just showed you there, selenizomai, actually. Selene is the Greek term for moon. And so it's people that were affected by the moon, they thought, you know, this type of deal, you know. And you know how things, you know, get ramped up around this, you know, the idea of moon, you know, what happens, you know, when the moon comes, you turn into a werewolf, you know. I've got to see all those Twilight movies because I know they're going to explain a lot to me. Actually, I'll never see any of them, frankly. But if you watch them, I don't care. But I don't believe in werewolves or vampires. So, but people, all kinds of weird things, you know, kind of come up around this about the night, the darkness, moon, and the way it affects people. And one of the things you can tell if you work in an emergency room or in retail is that when the moon gets full, people are different. And with that, we will close. But you will get out there in the public, you will find out that it does affect some people. Now, to what extent and all, you know, I don't fully know. All right, well, we'll stop there today, and we'll hopefully be able to wrap this up on Tuesday and then take a couple of day break. Thank you, Father, for the opportunity to assemble together with like-minded people. Thank you for the doctrine you continue to provide. We pray that you would sanctify this information to our souls. In Christ's name, amen.